We have with us today, on the far end, David Forte. David is a professor of law at Cleveland State University. He holds degrees from Harvard College, Manchester University in England, the University of Toronto, and Columbia University. During the Reagan administration, David served as chief counsel to the U.S. delegation to the United Nations. He has authored a number of briefs in the Supreme Court of the United States. He has consulted with the U.S. Department of State on human rights and international affairs. David is the author of the book, Islamic Law Studies, Classical and Contemporary Applications. To my immediate right is Samuel Tadros. Samuel is a research fellow at the Hudson Institute. Before joining Hudson in 2011, he was a senior partner at the Egyptian Union of Liberal Youth, an organization that aims to spread the ideas of classical liberalism in Egypt. Samuel earned his BA in political science from the American University in Cairo and his MA in democracy and governance from Georgetown University. Samuel is a professional lecturer at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. On my immediate left is Jacob Meshingama. Jacob is Director of Legal Affairs at the Center for Political Studies, a think tank based in Copenhagen. His work focuses on advocacy and research in the field of human rights with an emphasis on freedom of expression. In 2010, Jacob was voted the most influential Danish public intellectual under the age of 40 by the Danish newspaper Politiken. On my far left is Amjad Khan. Amjad is a senior litigation associate at Latham & Watkins Law Firm based in Los Angeles. He is a postgraduate research fellow at Harvard Law School and National Director of Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community USA. Amjad is a graduate of Claremont McKenna College and Harvard Law School, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Harvard Human Rights Law Journal. So I welcome all of our panelists today, and we'll start off with David Forte.
Good morning. If at any time in this echoless, cavernous room you cannot hear me and still wish to, please raise your hand. Laurel Gronum, spelled G-H-O-N-I-M, should be a hero of our age. This Egyptian young man, a Google executive, founded a Facebook page in 2010 called We Are All Khalid Said, referring to a young man who was tortured to death by the Egyptian police. From that Facebook page, he inspired and organized the revolution in Egypt that brought down Hosni Mubarak. In the early stages, he was arrested and held blindfolded in detention for 11 days, and upon his release, Gronum was greeted with joy by the crowds in Tahrir Square. Finally, on February 7th, Mubarak resigned, and the Egyptians planned for a great celebration 10 days later in Tahrir Square featuring Lael Gronum. But on that day, Lael Gronum did not speak. He was not allowed to speak. Instead, the agenda had been preempted by the Muslim Brotherhood, who, though caught flat-footed by the initial protests, soon gathered their strength to try to direct the revolution to their ends. Instead of Lael Gronum, the Muslim Brotherhood insisted that Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi speak to the hundreds of thousands of Egyptians in the square. A spiritual guide to the Muslim Brotherhood, Qaradawi credits Hassan al-Banna, the Islamist father of the Brotherhood, as having more influence over his life than any other man. Chased out of Egypt and excluded from entry into the United States, Qaradawi took himself to Qatar established the most watched television show of its type in the entire Muslim world. But Sheikh Karadawi is no Fulton J. Sheen. This man, the most influential religious figure in all of Sunni Islam, issues fatwas that reek in violence and in hate, and interviews and statements. Here's a couple of examples. February 8th, 2010. Quote, throughout history, Allah has imposed upon the Jews people who would punish them for their corruption. The last punishment was carried out by Hitler. By means of all the things he did to them, even though the Jews exaggerated this issue, he managed to put them in their place. This was divine punishment for them. Allah willing, the next time will be at the hand of the believers. January 28, 2009. O Allah, take this oppressive Jewish Zionist band of people. Do not spare a single one of them. O Allah, count their numbers and kill them down to the very last one. We don't know where the Egyptian revolution will lead, but we do know that there are now three major parties vying for power: the Muslim Brotherhood, Mubarak's old party, and the army. And while the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood calls for the extermination of the Jews, the army massacres Christians. In Tunisia, 60% of the seats have gone to the Islamist party. Although he signed an agreement that he would keep Tunisia's liberal law regarding women intact. Libya, the Islamists are now prominent, although there are some reports that perhaps the Sufi brotherhoods may exert a more humane influence. There's another salient fact that we should point out, though. A majority of Muslims live in countries, a number of these countries being majority Muslim, that are classified as functioning democracies. They include Indonesia, India, Bangladesh, Turkey, Albania, Senegal, Mali, and perhaps even unstable Pakistan. But except for the limping democracy in Iraq, no Arab-majority country is classified as a democracy. Lebanon, after a brief period of hope, has sunk back into a balkanized nation, with Syria and Hezbollah holding the upper hand. Turkey's democracy is seemingly becoming more Islamist and less tolerant to religious minorities. Saudi Arabia's declaration that women will have a say in how the totally powerless municipal councils are staffed is a charade. Yemen is sinking into being another Somalia, with Al-Qaeda in control of some areas in the south. Bahrain has successfully put down its rebels. Al-Bashir, the internationally indicted criminal at the head of the Sudan, has unleashed a new wave of genocidal attacks against the blacks in central Sudan in the name of imposing Sharia. And President Assad in Syria, with support from Iran, is maintaining his brutal hold on the country. It does not look good, this Arab Spring, at the present time. And it comes down to this, that most of the Islamist parties are using the idea of the Sharia as their emblem for the political program they wish to impose or have accepted by the people in their respective countries. So that brings us to have to talk about the role of the Sharia in modern Islam. Karadawi has actually changed. He believes in a new ijtihad, a change of the former jurisprudential aspects of the Sharia. But he has changed the Sharia in this regard. Under the classical Sharia, Muslims were not supposed to be residents in the Dar al-Harb, in the area of war. They could be traders, they could be denizens, they could be travelers, but they were not supposed to accept any rule that was not Muslim. Well, he has changed that. He has developed the doctrine of the transferred Dar al-Islam, namely that the realm of Islam can be transferred into areas of the Western world, so that there are pockets, whether they be in England or France and so forth, that are legitimately ruled by the Sharia. In this way, he has transferred immigrants into colonizers. And that is the cultural problem that, and political problem that, that Europe faces. The modern Sharia is not your father's Sharia. Not that you would want to live under your father's Sharia, but there's been a great deal of change, most of it for the worse. The history of the Sharia in classical Islam always had to make room for the state. No matter what people in the West or what Muslims tell you, that there was never the separation of church and state in Islam, as inapposite of those terms can be, talking about any medieval country, any medieval civilization, there were in fact two realms throughout Islamic history. And the dominant realm, that is the one that held the political upper hand, was always the state. The state, whether it be the early Abbasid or Umayyad empires, or the different way the Ottomans did it, always imposed state law over Sharia law whenever it was needed for state purposes. And the Qadis would have to recognize that and enforce state law in Ottoman Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire. And in the earlier empires, there were parallel state courts to the Sharia courts in which the Sultan or the Caliph had his way. The modern Sharia view does away with that bifurcation. And they wish to make the Sharia, the Islamist, the constitution of Islam, where as a matter of political description, it never was before. The modern radicals have married the Sharia to the Western notion of a monopoly of force. They have used Marxist conceptions so that they regard themselves, and some of them actually use this term, or some of their writers have used this term, as a vanguard, leading true Islam to its perfect apotheosis, and that any Muslim that does not follow Islam according to their particular viewpoints is, by definition, an infidel, an apostate, and can be put to death. So in the face of this this type of Islamism change in the Sharia, what we listen to and hope for is a development of moderate Islam. Now, moderate Islam is not Islam with less religion. It's actually Islam with more religion, more spirituality. What the radicals have done is to politicize and make an ideology out of the religion, so that the religion's whole focus is territorial and political power, not the spiritual benefit of its adherents. So when anyone talks about a moderate Muslim, I don't think of a moderate Muslim as a secularist. I think of a moderate Muslim as a person who treasures the spiritual basis of his religion, many Sufis, for example, and understands that the politicization of it through the modern Sharia is a distortion of what could be one of the great strengths of one of the great civilizations of the world. Let me give you an example in concluding, so I don't take time for my fellows here, of the kind of problem we face. I just received this a few days ago from a member of that wonderful forum. The Egypt's Grand Mufti, Sheikh Al-Goma, has declared that although Christians can be tolerated in a new Egypt, they are still to be regarded as infidels, kafir, probably the worst kind of term you can use in Islam. And this is the supposed dialogue, he says, can occur between a Muslim and a Christian. Now I'm quoting what he says, this hypothetical dialogue. The Christians say the following: "You have the wrong idea about us. We don't worship the Christ." The Muslims reply, "Okay, fine, we were under the wrong impression. But, by the way," quoting the Quran, "infidels are those who declare God is the Christ, Son of Mary." Christians respond, "But these are philosophical matters that we are unable to explain." Muslims reply, "Okay, fine, God is one, but by the way, quote, "Infidels are those who declare that God is the Christ, Son of Mary." Now, what can you do with this ignorance? The chief mufti of Egypt hasn't a clue as to what Christian belief is about. But all he can do is typify them as unbelievers. That's the problem you have with the modern Sharia. It divides the world into an ideological Islam, not a religious Islam, an ideological Islam, and a perceived ideological Christianity. And what we wait for is the development of the moderate Muslim voice, the moderate religious Muslim voice, who will turn these radicals back to the spiritual roots of what was their religion. Thank you.
Good morning. Hope you can all hear me well. I wanted to begin by thanking the Federalist Society for inviting me to this very important symposium and seminar, and honored to be here. I also wanted to congratulate Paul Marshall and Nina Shea on their new book, which I've had occasion to devour last night when I received it. It's quite the read. And it's quite extensive and exhaustive. In the ongoing debate about religious defamation, the global debate, perhaps little attention has been paid to how blasphemy laws in Muslim countries adversely impact Muslim communities. And that very important question has been answered quite well by both of them in this book, and I'm very pleased to read that. In fact, such blasphemy laws, I contend, are problematic and dangerous precisely because they bring harm to a wide range and diverse group of religions, be it Christianity, Hinduism, or Islam. So my task today is really to give you a brief overview and introduction to how the blasphemy laws in two Muslim countries, Pakistan and Indonesia, are suffocating the human rights of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, a group that has several million members in Pakistan and several hundred thousand members in Indonesia. So before I do that, who are the Ahmadis? Who is the Ahmadiyya Muslim community? Well, Ahmadis belong to a contemporary messianic movement founded in 1889 by Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, who was born in a small village of Qadian in India. The fundamental difference between the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and the Sunni Muslim majority concerns the identity of the Messiah, the reformer that the Prophet Muhammad predicted would appear after him, and that all Muslims in the world currently await. The Ahmadis believe that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad was that Messiah, and his chief aim and purpose was to revive Islam by ending religious wars, condemning bloodshed, and reinstituting morality, justice, and peace. And the community claims a worldwide membership of several million in over 195 countries, and the largest concentration of Ahmadis are in South Asia and West Africa. So that's just a brief overview of who the Ahmadis are, which is very important to understand as I make my way through this talk. Now, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is arguably the most persecuted Muslim community in the world. The U.S. State Department, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and dozens of international human rights organizations have documented the systematic persecution of the Ahmadis at the hands of governments and extremists. It's quite well chronicled. Now, let me turn first to Pakistan. There are an estimated 4 million Ahmadi Muslims living in Pakistan. There are varying estimates, but most of the estimates in aggregate say there are several million Ahmadis in Pakistan. Now, Ahmadis, and this is very important, profess to be Muslims, but their belief is irrelevant under the law. And that is because Pakistan is the only Islamic state in the world to define who is or is not a Muslim for purposes of its constitution. And this is in Article 260 of its constitution. And more importantly, the Second Amendment to Pakistan's constitution explicitly declares that the Ahmadis are non-Muslim by law. So the main reason why Ahmadis are severely persecuted in Pakistan is because they are legally stripped of their right to self-identify as Muslims. So now I want to turn briefly to the question of blasphemy in Pakistan. So since 1984, since the regime of General ضیاء-الحق, Pakistan has used its criminal code to prohibit and punish blasphemy. And blasphemy in Pakistan broadly refers to any spoken or written representation that, quote unquote, directly or indirectly outrages the religious sentiments of Muslims. And 5 of Pakistan's penal code provisions punish blasphemy. And these are collectively referred to as the anti-blasphemy laws. Now, over the course of 26 or 27 years, more than 1,000 people have been arrested under these laws. And these individuals were Muslims, be they Sunni, Shia, or Ahmadi, Christians, and Hindus. A little known fact is that the majority of arrests under these laws in Pakistan are actually of Muslims, not Ahmadis or Christians, but Muslims. And the crimes range from, for example, wearing an Islamic slogan on a t-shirt to planning to build a mosque or distributing Islamic literature in a public square or offering prayers in a mosque or putting Arabic script on a wedding invitation card or sending a text message that's perceived to be critical of Islam. These are all actual cases. The punishments for these crimes range from fines, indefinite detention, life imprisonment, or the death sentence. And although no one to date has been executed in Pakistan for blasphemy, at least 32 individuals have been killed by mobs after having been arrested for blasphemy. So Pakistan's anti-blasphemy laws continue in full force and effect today. They incite religious extremism and silence the opinions of both Muslim and non-Muslim minorities. And as I mentioned, this is well documented. The U.S. State Department's recent reports on Pakistan point out how, quote, authorities routinely use the anti-blasphemy laws to harass religious minorities and vulnerable Muslims and to settle personal scores or business rivalries. Amnesty International reports, Pakistan's anti-blasphemy laws are, quote, a handy tool to silence debate and dissent. Human Rights Watch reports that, quote, Pakistan's continued use of its blasphemy laws against religious minorities is disgraceful and must be repealed. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom described the anti-blasphemy laws as, quote, restricting religious freedom and fostering vigilante violence. Now, I mentioned there are 5 anti-blasphemy laws in Pakistan. The most notorious of these laws is a 50-word penal code ordinance known as Section 295C. Now, there are several of you in the audience who are lawyers, and lawyers have a strange fascination for statutes. And so I thought I would actually read out the 50 words. So that all of you can have an understanding of how broad this law really is. And this is the blasphemy law, applying to all religions in Pakistan. Quote, whoever, by words, either spoken or written, or by visible representation, or by any imputation, innuendo, or insinuation, directly or indirectly, defiles the sacred name of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, shall be punished with death or imprisonment for life, and shall also be liable to fine. But based on this incredibly broad and vague language, virtually anyone can register a blasphemy case against anyone else in Pakistan, and the accused can face capital punishment. Now, with respect to the Ahmadis, Pakistan's anti-blasphemy laws have criminalized their very existence. Two of those five laws, I read one of them, two of those laws specifically by name target the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, and these are what are known as Martial Law Ordinance 20, which amended Pakistan's Penal Code and Press Publication Ordinances, Section 298B and C. And for fear of being charged with, quote, and this is the language of these laws, indirectly or directly posing as a Muslim, Ahmadis cannot profess their faith verbally or in writing. Virtually any public act of worship, devotion, or propagation by an Ahmadi can be treated as a criminal offense punishable by death, a fine, life imprisonment. And the Supreme Court of Pakistan, in a decision in 1993, Zahiruddin versus State, upheld the constitutionality of Ordinance 20, which is a very significant fact. Now, Ahmadis account for about 40% of all the arrests under Pakistan's blasphemy laws. And the situation grows dire each passing year. In 2009, for example, there were four Ahmadi school teenagers in the Leia district who were formally charged with blasphemy for allegedly writing the name of Muhammad on the walls of a mosque's toilet. And the teenagers, the youngest was 14, remained behind bars without bail for 6 months, and they continue to face blasphemy charges even today. And according to the BBC, the charges they face are purely fabricated. And there are cases like this that are not uncommon in Pakistan. In prior years, elderly Ahmadi women, Ahmadi mothers, even Ahmadi babies have fallen victim to the anti-blasphemy laws. And the persecution of the Ahmadis in Pakistan goes beyond individual arrests. Under the guise of these laws, Pakistani governmental authorities have demolished, set on fire, forcibly occupied, sealed, or barred the construction of over 90 Ahmadi mosques. They have denied the cemetery burial of 41 Ahmadis and have exhumed, after burial, the bodies of 28 Ahmadis. In addition, Pakistan's security forces, which are in the news today, don't adequately protect Ahmadis from attacks by extreme groups who justify their behavior by invoking these laws. For example, on May 28, 2010, the community watched in horror as the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the Pakistani Taliban, gunned down and massacred 86 Ahmadis in two mosques while they were offering Friday prayers. And this was the largest single attack on the Ahmadi community in its history. And in 2010 alone, 99 Ahmadis were killed and murdered, including these 86. What's significant about this incident is the police in Lahore knew of the operations that were taking place and did nothing to stop it, despite the fact that the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan had written a letter to them explicitly saying that such a threat was imminent. In the end, 86 people were dead. So before I get to Indonesia now, let me highlight two other issues that Ahmadis face that are really unique to Ahmadis and very tragic because they only affect the Ahmadis. And I mentioned the breadth of the law, and the Christian persecution in Pakistan is well documented. And the new book by Paul and Nina does a great job of chronicling that. But these two issues are unique to Ahmadis. The first issue concerns the right to vote in Pakistan. So in Pakistan, from 1978 to 2002, there was a separate electorate. What that meant was that non-Muslims, which included Christians and Hindus and Ahmadis, were put on a separate electoral roll, and they can vote for separate candidates, minority candidates for minority seats. And Muslims were on a completely different roll. Now, this was a regime that was well criticized by the international community. So in 2002, President Musharraf passed an executive order, Executive Order 7, that eliminated that and said there will be a joint electorate. All Pakistani citizens can vote for any and all candidates as equal citizens. So this was heralded as a very positive step. But 4 months later, he passed Executive Order 15 that said, quote, the status of Ahmadis remains unchanged. So in order for Ahmadis to vote, they must declare themselves to be non-Muslim, declare their founder to be an imposter, and add their names to a supplemental list that is completely separate and apart from all other citizens who are on the joint list. Well, not surprisingly, they are the only religious group that is effectively disenfranchised, and no Ahmadi would follow those preconditions and therefore have boycotted the elections. Very ironic, because Ahmadis are extremely literate, extremely well-educated, and came out in large numbers when this joint electorate was reinstated. But by a stroke of a pen, 3 months later, President Musharraf effectively and to date disenfranchised the Ahmadi community. They cannot vote. And the second issue that's unique to Ahmadis is the Pakistani passport application form. So the government of Pakistan designates religious affiliation on your passport. Now, all Muslims in Pakistan, when they have to apply for a passport to travel or get their passport renewed, they have to fill out a form that says, I declare that the Ahmadi Muslim community is non-Muslim and that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, their founder, is an imposter. So in other words, the government of Pakistan forces all Pakistani Muslims who seek passports, regardless of whatever reason they're applying for, to swear and declare under penalty of perjury that they're opposed to the Ahmadis. So this, in a nutshell, is the situation in Pakistan. Now, briefly, in Indonesia. Now, the Ahmadi Muslim community in Indonesia is roughly 250,000 strong, and they were established in 1925. Now, on February 6th earlier this year, more than 1,000 extremists of the Islamic Defenders Front, and many of them were brandishing machetes, spears, and sticks, they attacked a house of an Ahmadi Muslim leader in Chisasik in West Java, and 20 Ahmadis were inside the home. And they beat to death 3 Ahmadis. Now, 2 really salient facts about this. First, there were several dozen Indonesian police officers who watched. Second, the entire beating was captured on video by Human Rights Watch and went viral immediately on February 6th. And these 3 Ahmadis, one was 34. He was beaten and mutilated with a knife. He survived by his pregnant wife. The second was 38. He survived by his wife and 4 children. And the third was 35. And he survived by his wife and 2 daughters. They're all very young. And scores of newspaper articles have brought attention to this. Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and they were roundly denounced, these attacks, by the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Ambassador to Indonesia, the U.S. Commission. But what this attack did is it sent shockwaves in a country that is perceived to be quite moderate, and it was an important moment, I contend, in Indonesia's history, because it brought to the forefront this discussion that had been sort of tabled for a long time. And that is about Indonesia's blasphemy law, which a lot of people are unfamiliar with. So briefly, in the interest of time, On January 27, 1965, President Sukarno enacted a blasphemy law. And that took legal effect in 1969. And that law makes it unlawful to, quote, intentionally in public communicate, counsel, or solicit public support for an interpretation of a religion or a form of religious activity that is similar to the interpretations or activities of an Indonesian religion, but deviates from the tenets of that religion. And what the blasphemy law does is it acknowledges only six religions in Indonesia, six approved religions: Islam, Protestant Christianity, Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism. But it does not acknowledge the varying sects and strands within those faiths. And the blasphemy law establishes that the government will protect its official religions by punishing those who insult approved religions and those who attempt to dissuade others to adhere to unofficial religions. And there are civil and criminal penalties for these violations, and I won't go into the details, but Article 156A of the Criminal Code attaches a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment for intentionally criticizing or attempting to undermine the government's officially recognized religions. Now, why is this important? Well, in 1980, the MUI, the Ulama Council, the highest religious body in Indonesia, passed a fatwa declaring the Ahmadis to be not a legitimate form of Islam. And since that fatwa, there has been, and the MUI is funded by the Indonesian government, there has been an enormous crackdown on the Ahmadis. And this came to a head in 2008 when government ministers passed a joint decree that banned all activities of the Ahmadi community as deviant. And they did so to protect law and order. The result of that was that there were over 100 attacks on the Ahmadis in just 3 years, including the three that I mentioned earlier. And so my last few points on this are simply that the blasphemy law in Indonesia is now becoming intensely scrutinized, but the Constitutional Court in Indonesia upheld by a vote of 8-1 its constitutionality in 2010. So now we're at a stage where at least six provinces have banned the Ahmadi community, and we're nearing the time where Ahmadis would be banned outright, the way they have been banned in Pakistan. So in conclusion, these were just a thumbnail sketch, really, of the persecution of Ahmadis in Pakistan and Indonesia. They endure unconscionable persecution around the world. But my point is that the source of this persecution are extremists who would pervert Islam to nefarious ends, but the battle against these extremists in places like Pakistan or Indonesia cannot be won unless their governments reform or repeal the blasphemy laws that give ammunition to these extremists. It's simply not enough to apprehend and uproot extreme groups like the Pakistani Taliban. The U.S. has to push these countries to repeal these laws in order to dismantle the extremist apparatus that really endangers the world. And ultimately, this is the only way to empower the most moderate Muslim voices in the world. Thank you.
Well, it's an honor to be speaking at this event, and I'm very grateful to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I'm also delighted to be speaking at the same conference as Nina Shea and Paul Marshall, whose new book, Silenced, I've had the opportunity to review for National Review. The book is, I think, indispensable to anyone seeking to understand the degree to which the freedoms of religion, expression, and conscience are being violated in many Muslim-majority countries, and why this development has serious consequences for international law and indeed here in the West. So the book underscores how crucial it is to resist the ongoing attempts to turn Islamic blasphemy laws into international law through human rights language. Now, this attempt to prohibit criticism or so-called defamation of Islam under human rights law is part of an international campaign waged by the 56 member state Organization of Islamic Cooperation, formerly the Organization of Islamic Conference, which was set up in 1969 based in Saudi Arabia. The members of the OIC include Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Iran, and Egypt, who all combine systematic repression of religious minorities at home with rigorous campaigning for limiting criticism of Islam abroad. In 1990, the OIC member states adopted their own Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam, which seeks to unite Islam and human rights. However, what characterizes the Cairo Declaration is that all the rights in the Declaration are subject to the often illiberal and oppressive rules of Islamic Sharia law. So take Article 21, which states that, quote, everyone shall have the right to express his opinion freely, but then adds, in such manner as would not be contrary to the principles of the Sharia, basically negating the right promised. In a debate at the UN, an OIC official clarified what subjecting free speech to Sharia entails, quote, in the opinion of the OIC, the right to freedom of thought, opinion, and expression can in no case justify blasphemy, end quote. Also, as we have seen at this conference, and as you can read in Silenced, the OIC definition of blasphemy is often very broad, extremely arbitrary, and far-reaching, posing problems for religious minorities and Muslims alike. And it is these kind of laws that the OIC want to turn into international human rights norms. The first resolution tabled by Pakistan on behalf of the OIC in 1999 was introduced as defamation of Islam. But after some debate, the title was changed to defamation of religions. This resolution expresses, among other things, deep concern at negative stereotyping of religions, as well as concern at any role in which the media or any other means is used to incite acts of xenophobia or related intolerance towards Islam and any other religion. Now, despite this, the resolution's quite hostile wording towards free speech, both the 1999 and 2000 resolutions on defamation of religions were adopted unanimously without a vote in the Commission on Human Rights at the UN. And I think it's clear that the initial acceptance of the concept of defamation of religions by Western states, including the US, undoubtedly helped the agenda of the OIC. So since 2001, the resolutions on defamation became increasingly comprehensive and hostile to freedom of expression, and then Western states started to push back, and they were put to a vote in the Commission on Human Rights, later reformed to the Human Rights Council, though the practice has not become much better, and also the General Assembly. The battle over Islam and free speech has also played out during public debates at the UN, where both Pakistan and Egypt have managed to prevent a critical NGO from discussing Sharia, as it would be, quote, insulting to our faith to discuss Sharia here in this forum. In other words, having the United Nations Human Rights Council act as an organ to enforce OIC blasphemy standards. However, from Peking in 2003, the resolutions on defamation of religion have steadily lost votes both in the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly. So in 2003 in the Commission, 32 countries voted in favor, 14 against, and 7 abstained. In 2010, the numbers were 20, 17, and 8 respectively. So this dwindling support, as well as the murder of two Pakistani politicians who were critical of Pakistan's blasphemy laws, I think have been key to the OIC realization that the defamation agenda is counterproductive at the moment. So earlier this year, the OIC chose not to table a resolution against defamation at the Human Rights Council, opting instead for a consensus resolution aimed at combating intolerance and negative stereotyping of persons based on religion or belief. This was celebrated by many as a major victory for free speech, since the resolution omitted any reference to defamation. But I think it's crucial to note that while the campaign to prohibit defamation may have run out of steam, the campaign to limit criticism of Islam under human rights law is far from over. Indeed, rather than a sign of the of OIC defeat, the new Human Rights Council resolution should be seen as the latest instance of a change in tactics by the OIC. Now, the concept of defamation of religions has no basis in international human rights law, which poses a problem to the OIC, because international human rights law generally protects individuals and not religions as such. However, international human rights law does include hate speech prohibitions that encompass religion. So Article 20 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is ratified by the U.S., states, though with a reservation to this particular provision, states that, quote, any advocacy of religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination or hostility shall be prohibited by law. Now, the new consensus resolution that I mentioned, which the OIC went along with, includes several references to the wording of Article 20, but it also mentions, quote, derogatory stereotyping, negative profiling, and stigmatization of persons based on their religion or belief. This wording is extremely vague and unclear and falls well below the threshold established by Article 20. The resolution, therefore, should be seen as an attempt by the OIC to broaden the scope of Article 20 to include instances of so-called Islamophobia and, indeed, defamation. One of the latest examples of this agenda could be witnessed at Denmark, my home country's Universal Periodic Review at the Human Rights Council. The Universal Periodic Review is basically a human rights examination of all member states of the United Nations, and this took place in May 2011. Numerous OIC states complained that Islamophobia was ubiquitous in Denmark and recommended that Denmark strengthen its enforcement of hate speech laws. The representative of Pakistan stated, among other things, that the newspaper publication of cartoons about the Prophet Muhammad shocked Muslims worldwide and violated Articles 19 and 20 of ICCPR. So here you have it again, defamation now turned into hate speech. And with reference to the Muhammad cartoons, Indonesia urged Denmark to prevent the reoccurrence of such irresponsible acts, which merely perpetuate religious hatred and intolerance. And these are just a few examples of quite a lot from OIC member states, basically urging Denmark to impose censorship and punishing Islamophobia. Now, disturbingly, the Danish government chose to accept these recommendations with reference to its existing hate speech laws. Now, while Denmark is unlikely to amend the scope of the applicable laws according to the wishes of the OIC, the acceptance of the recommendations is nonetheless a small victory for the OIC. After all, the basic premise that the Muhammad cartoons and the Danish public Danish debate about Islam and immigration constitutes hatred contrary to ICCPR Article 20 went unchallenged by the Danish government, who was clearly intimidated by the concerted efforts of the OIC states. Now, the new OIC strategy based on broadening existing hate speech provisions is, I think, much more likely to succeed than would be a continued insistence on combating defamation of religion. Because most Western states have abolished or ceased enforcing blasphemy laws, but all Western countries except the U.S. have hate speech laws in place that are often actively enforced. In fact, in 2008, the European Union adopted a framework decision that obliges all European Union member states to criminalize incitement to hate speech, including on the basis of religion. The European Court of Human Rights under the Council of Europe generally does not protect hate speech and has upheld the conviction of numerous politicians, journalists, intellectuals who are critical of Islam and Muslim immigration, as well as the confiscation and censorship of films insulting the feelings of Christians. Moreover, most Western human rights organizations, even ones dedicated specifically to freedom of expression, while opposed to the concept of defamation of religion, support hate speech laws and their enforcement. In the logic of those who oppose defamation of religions but support hate speech laws, it would thus be incompatible with freedom of expression to criminalize harsh attacks against Islam on the basis of defamation, while such criticism could plausibly be criminalized on the grounds of inciting hatred against Muslims under hate speech laws, as has happened in numerous European cases. So while technically defamation and hate speech are distinct categories, they do overlap, and in the OIC interpretation become almost indivisible. So unlike the situation with defamation of religion, Western states and mainstream human rights activists cannot reject an attempt by the OIC at broadening Article 20 out of hand without the risk of being accused of double standards. And that is a powerful and persuasive accusation at the UN, where Western states are often in the minority and on the defensive, and therefore have to compromise. If this strategy meets with success, the OIC will have achieved smuggling the concept of defamation of religion in through the back door, using hate speech provisions expanded to act as de facto blasphemy laws censoring criticism of Islam according to inherently vague legal norms that lack any objective criteria. Such laws can then be used to justify harsh repression in Muslim-majority countries and limiting the free debate on Islam in the West, and all of this in the name of human rights and tolerance. Considering the systematic repression of minorities and the denial of basic human rights in many Muslim-majority countries, it defies belief that the OIC has been able to dominate the agenda of the Human Rights Council with its insistence that defamation of religion and Islamophobia be prohibited under human rights law. However, it is important to note that existing hate speech laws are not the result of Muslim states and that not only critics of Islam are being targeted. As we have seen, these restrictions on freedom of expression have a basis in international human rights law. But it is seldom acknowledged that the prohibition against hate speech in human rights law owes its existence to totalitarian communist states led by the Soviet Union, who won the vote when Article 20 of the ICCPR was debated at the UN during the Cold War. Most free democracies of the day were opposed to this development and voted against this provision. The critics included the U.S. representative and chairwoman of the Commission on Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt, who in the 50s warned that prohibiting hatred would, quote, encourage governments to punish all criticism under the guise of protecting against religious or national hostility. And she was right. Authoritarian states were allowed to turn the concept of human rights into newspeak, legitimizing the very repression that human rights were supposed to guard against. And tragically, the victory of totalitarian states long since banished to the ash heap of history has consequences for how Muslims and non-Muslims alike can discuss Islam today. Therefore, the international hate speech laws pushed by the OIC are therefore a poisonous legacy of totalitarianism. While the pressure to prohibit certain forms of expression under human rights law is not a novel development, the concerted efforts to increase the scope of hate speech laws to include Islamophobia has created a new dividing line on the extent to which free speech should be limited. This time, the dividing line is not between the West and communist states, but between the West and Islamic states, with the West fighting reluctantly, with one hand tied behind their backs by the very hate speech laws pushed by the OIC. One of the basic arguments underlying hate speech laws is that these encourage tolerance. But criminalizing offensive speech amounts to turning the very concept of tolerance on its head. According to this logic, freedom of expression and religion are conflicting rights, and the latter entails a right not to be offended through the exercise of the former. An understanding that would have been deeply alien to the founders of this great country, who understood that these rights are indivisible and therefore included them in the same constitutional amendment. With protection for a loosely defined concept like religion, the self-proclaimed victims will be the ones who can determine when they feel offended and have governments to back them up. That is, of course, particularly dangerous in countries where the state is the guardian of religion, like Saudi Arabia and Iran, since the prohibition will affect not only the ability to freely discuss religion, but also the ability to criticize the government. But it also empowers self-appointed representatives of Muslims in the West who use hate speech and blasphemy laws to limit criticism of Islam at a time when discussion of Islam is more needed than ever. And this has negative consequences not only for free speech, but also for the many Western Muslims who accept and support that free speech cannot be limited by religious feelings, but whose voices risk becoming marginalized if through legal protection the sensibilities of fundamentalists become monopolized. Since European states have long since accepted the logic of hate speech laws, it is crucial that America, with its First Amendment tradition, assume global leadership in the protection of free speech and religion. Such a role, of course, is likely to create diplomatic tensions, but without American leadership, there is simply no state willing or able to champion these values based on principle. Yet, there are signs that the current administration may be willing to relax America's traditional principled stance. A worrying example is the Obama administration's co-sponsoring at the UN of a resolution on freedom of speech with Egypt in October 2009. The resolution condemns, as we've heard before, negative religious stereotyping. This concept clearly does not reflect the Brandenburg versus Ohio First Amendment standard, and as mentioned, is not even included as one of the permissible restrictions of free speech under international human rights law, and therefore constitutes an expansive interpretation of the prohibition against hate speech. This, of course, was clearly the purpose of the OIC, whose representative at the vote stated that negative stereotyping or defamation of religions was a modern expression of religious hatred and xenophobia, thereby again linking hate speech and defamation as overlapping or indivisible categories. Now this, of course, was not the interpretation the US had in mind. In December, the US State Department will likely hold the second joint conference with the OIC aimed at defining and combating negative religious stereotyping, thereby lending legitimacy to the OIC's agenda and underlying premise that it is in the West, not in the OIC countries, that religious minorities are being discriminated and persecuted. Respect for freedom of expression and religion is the hallmark of free societies and the first rights to be circumscribed by liberal states. It is a sad reflection on contemporary human rights norms, and indeed on Europe, that the increasing emphasis on shielding Muslims from offensive and blasphemous words is championed by the liberal states of the OIC, taking their cue from the legacy of the totalitarian states with which Western Europe was locked in an ideological battle during the Cold War. If the concept of human rights is to serve freedom, then surely, to paraphrase Orwell, freedom of expression and religion must include the right to tell people what they do not want to hear. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak at the conference today. As is obvious from the various speakers before me, Egypt was mentioned quite a bit in the discussion today. And perhaps thus a discussion of the situation in Egypt needs no defense in terms of its application for other countries in the region and in terms of the Egyptian role that is played to spread such blasphemy laws in the world in general through Egyptian diplomatic efforts that coordinate with the Obama administration and that build support within the non-allied movement and various African and Asian countries. It is thus my aim to speak of the situation in Egypt, trying to draw the political picture of who the players are and how they create a society that is unwelcoming of free speech and of free thought as an idea in the first place. The players that we have in their attempt to create this environment that does not welcome the freedom of thought and expression are three main players. It is the governments, the religious establishment, and the Islamists. Each of them has their own goals and their own interests in stopping freedom of speech, but it is the dynamic relationship between those three that creates this environment that is both unwelcoming of one's individual expression and thought, but also the environment that creates a society that is welcoming to the very ideas that we aim to defeat in the war on terrorism. And that's a society that welcomes fundamentalist ideas. The first player in this regard is the Egyptian state, and of course an example of other states in the region. The state viewing Islam as a possible tool by its opposition attempts to control and monopolize usage of Islam. Thus, it is the main interest of the state that no one else is capable of offering another interpretation that would challenge the norm, that Islam is not used to offer any alternative to that state, both by the Islamists as well as by reformers that attempt to challenge the state's monopoly. The religious establishment, of course, naturally believes that it is the only one entitled to offer that interpretation of what Islam is and what is permissible and not permissible under Islam. For the Islamists, with their more radical interpretation of the religion, it is the method that they challenge the governments with. It is the tool that they find to curb any other alternative to their ideas. Those three, and it is of course the very challenge of those ideas that modern Islamism was built as a rejection to of Western ideals being spread in the region. This relationship between those three forces and the interplay between them is what we will see with the various cases that we'll discuss. But the general atmosphere created by those three elements, by those three forces, is an intolerant society that is encouraged and in turn encourages the three forces to continue on this assault on freedom of expression and thought. The targets of those attacks, of those blasphemy laws, are different in their shape and form. The first is naturally religious minorities, the prime example in Egypt being the Baha'i community. The second group is groups that are viewed as non-Islamic, as deviant groups within Islam. Shia interpretations, the Shia minority, the Quranist group, which attempts to reject many of the most radical hadiths and interpret Islam solely through the Quran, are also a main target. The third group are usually the converts, conversion in Egypt being a one-way ticket to Islam, but not outside of Islam. The fourth group, novelists, whose novels may contain any passages deemed insulting to the religion, with the final group, perhaps the most important, being those reformer thinkers that attempt to offer a different interpretation of religion. The methods used to silence those groups and to put limitations on them vary considerably. First, we have the second article of the Egyptian constitution, which states that not only is Islam the religion of the state, but that Islamic jurisprudence, Sharia, is the principal source of legislation. While this is a constitutional article, it has had its implications on specific cases in courts, with judges that hold very unwelcoming views to freedom of expression and thought using this article to state in their judgments that this is and is not allowed, even if the laws do not allow them to do so. So we've had a number of incidents of judges stating that since Islam, for example, is the religion of the state and the main source, then, although there is no article in the Egyptian law that prohibits conversion specifically, that because Islam does not allow conversion, thus you should not be allowed to convert. That because Islam is the last of the heavenly religions as described, then conversion is only to the better religions, that God offered those religions in an orderly fashion. Judaism, then Christianity, then Islam. The natural move that one should follow and not the reverse. The second method is the legal code itself, with Article 98F of the legal code stating, prohibiting any insulting or ridiculing of heavenly religions. Of course, this in practice only means Islam being protected from such slander. The third tool is naturally the religious fatwas, issued either by the religious establishment itself or by Islamist scholars and used in the court cases as well as separately to incite violence and harm to those deemed deviant. The fourth element is the book banning, with Al-Azhar being given power by the Egyptian state to decide what is deemed appropriate for publication and what is not, the result of which is enormous number of books being banned, including, as stated by Paul in the first discussion won by Naguib Mahfouz, the Nobel Prize winner, as well as many other thinkers. The other methods used against those thinkers and religious minorities are individual court cases called the Hizba, used by Islamist lawyers to basically accuse anyone they don't agree with of being blasphemous to Islam or an apostate. And finally, arrests and intimidation by the Egyptian state. The last element, of course, being death, and that on the hands of Islamist groups, just such as we saw with the Egyptian thinker Farag Fouda in the 90s. Those different methods used, we can view them in the different cases, how the interplay between the three political elements plays with that cases. The case of the Baha'is, for example, is notable. The Baha'i community is legally banned in Egypt. They are not allowed to have either houses of worship or practically to exist. Egyptian law requires that individuals, any Egyptian individual, should have a national ID card. The national ID card, of course, states what your religion is. The options available for the individual are Muslim, Christian, or Jew. Others are not allowed. Those are the only religions allowed by the state. The result is that Baha'is cannot possibly have national IDs. What this means in practice is that you cannot travel to any hotel, stay at any hotel, since that would require a national ID, that you cannot get married, and when you get married, that marriage is not recognized by the state, that your children won't have birth certificates and thus won't be able to find an education. And since the law requires you to have that national ID, that you can be arrested at any given moment because you do not carry appropriate identification. The Baha'is have attempted to get this legal identification and to state their religion on the national ID. The state, of course, refuses. The religious establishment issues the fatwas that Baha'is are apostates and should not be allowed to state their religion. That Egypt only protects the heavenly religion and thus Baha'is should not be allowed to. The Islamists threaten to attack the Baha'is and indeed in one case burn Baha'i houses in the south of Cairo, about 300 kilometers south of Cairo, in one of the villages that they live. This, again, interplay we see with the cases of a Muslim reformer such as Nasr Hamid Abu Zaid, who's written one of the final chapters in the book that you have that we're discussing today. Nasr Hamid Abu Zaid's trouble begins when he decides to apply for a promotion for a full professor in Egypt, providing the committee that would look to recommend his promotion with two of his major books. The committee decides, according to one of its members, that those books are extremely deviant from Islam and considered blasphemous and constitute apostate, that Nasr Hamid Abu Zaid is an apostate as a result, according to Abdusabur Shaheen, one of the people writing those reports. This report automatically gets published in Islamist newspapers who call on the government to take action against Nasr Hamid Abu Zaid. The mosques call for his death in their sermons. The Islamists use this Hizba tool and raise court cases to divorce him from his wife, since under Islam, a Muslim woman cannot possibly marry a non-Muslim, someone like Nasr. Nasser, of course, maintains throughout this whole episode that he is still a Muslim and that he is only offering a different interpretation of Islamic traditions, not even the Quran itself, but of the Islamic traditions developed by the different scholars in the Middle Ages. Nasser's troubles reach the level where the courts actually declare that he is an apostate and that he should be separated from his wife. Faced with that and with death threats, he is forced to flee to the Netherlands, where he lives there until he dies very recently. Those different episodes and how the different parties compete with each other in which enforces the more restrictions on freedom, with the government being pressured by the Islamists and giving the Islamists back, competing with them on looking more Islamic, with the religious establishment stopping any form of debate. What does this mean to Egypt's future? We've had now, 9 months ago, an Egyptian revolution uprising, and elections are going to take place very soon in Egypt. I have no crystal ball, but I can very easily predict the Islamists will win. They will win, not because they are only well organized, they surely are, but because they are the only ones that are able to provide an ideology and a clear vision for society. In the absence of any competing ideology, that is the only available solution for the Egyptians. For this reason, I think it's very important to look at the Muslim Brotherhood and what they aim to achieve in Egypt. They have given us, often accused of not elaborating on their ideas. This time they have. Forced to form or willing to form a political party, they have given us a 93-page long document of their vision for Egypt of the future. The document, in its first pages, declares what they believe the role of their political party is. This is quite interesting. The role of the political party, according to the Muslim Brotherhood, is cleansing the soul and hearts, upgrading the feelings, refining the character by calling for a commitment to worship, good manners, sociability, and behavior, and to remind people of God, the Day of Judgment, so as to wake up conscience. With that definition of their role, it is no wonder that that program contains article after article of how they will restrict all forms of freedom of expression. Civil society, for example, is welcomed, but only if that civil society operates not separate or against from what they call the basic values of society. Cinema is encouraged, but only if this cinema, as they declare, should help the government to create role models for Egyptians who are now lacking role models. The research and scientific research is encouraged, but only if that scientific research is, as they claim they aim, to create a researcher committed to the ethics and basic values, again, of society. The party emphasizes, this is perhaps one of the weirdest lines ever written, the importance of self-censorship by Egyptians individuals. With that in mind, the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood dominating the government, and thus the three factors, the religious establishment falling completely and effectively under their control, and them themselves controlling the government, will mean only that those three forces will be effectively united in stopping all attempts to offer a different view. Why should we care about such a thing? While it's important to defend the Egyptians' freedom and their possibility to offer a different interpretation, the United States has a practical interest in the matter outside of our own defense of those ideals. If someone like Farag Fouda is not capable of challenging the myths of Islamic history, then those myths, the myth of the great Islamic society of the past, will continue to be the model that is offered for the Egyptians and that they will vote for. If Master Hamid Abu Zayd is not capable of challenging those traditions, those interpretations of traditions, then the only interpretations available will be the ones that the Islamists offer. If no one is capable of offering an alternative interpretation inside Islam, then we are basically agreeing that the Islamists are Islam, and that they are the sole representatives of what a pious Muslim should and should not be. With the West perhaps unwilling or uninterested anymore, without the capacity to defend its own ideals and the very philosophical foundations of its society, and internal dissent inside Muslim countries being controlled by both the governments and the Islamists and the religious establishment, we will continue to lose this battle of ideas. While the battle is being fought both in Afghanistan, Iraq, in Pakistan, in Somalia, there is also a battle that needs to be fought on the minds of people. And in that regard, we're losing. We're completely losing. Thank you.